podcast is sponsored by Reflex Medical. Reflex Medical specialises in consumables and equipment supply solutions for clinicians in pre-hospital care. Their product range includes advanced diagnostics, syringes, cannulas, defibrillators and everything in between, with a commitment to enhance patient care and healthcare efficiency. With a passion for advancing patient care and safety, Reflex Medical strive to address evolving healthcare challenges, ensuring their contributions lead to improved treatment and overall well-being. Through dedicated research and development, their aim is to shape the future of pre-hospital care with a positive impact on the healthcare industry globally. To explore their range of products and services, see the show notes for further details. Also, check out the show notes for a 10% discount code on their products. Many thanks. This podcast is brought to you by Celox Medical. Celox Medical offers innovative hemostatic solutions for managing moderate to severe bleeding in emergency medical settings. Their advanced products like Celox granules and gauze harness Chytosan's clotting properties to swiftly control hemorrhage. Specifically designed for healthcare professionals and emergency responders, Celox Medical's range ensures rapid and effective clotting even in complex scenarios. This facilitates emergency and interventional procedures. Their range strictly adheres to safety standards and also empowers medical teams to address critical bleeding situations with confidence. So Celox Medical's commitment to efficacy and safety make it the hemostatic solution indispensable to hospitals, clinics and emergency care units, enhancing patient outcomes but also saving lives by stopping bleeding efficiently. Through dedication to research and development, they aim to shape the future of hemorrhage control and make a positive impact on the healthcare industry but ultimately save lives worldwide. To explore their range of products and services, please see the show notes for further details.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to be looking at the psychology and psychiatry of addiction with Dr. Brian Wells. This is the third part in the trilogy on addiction on the podcast. And in this conversation, we really wanted to examine a working definition of addiction, but we also want to look at the meta substances, so stimulants, sedatives, and opiates that are involved in addiction. We also want to look at the time horizon of an addicted person and some of the triggers of addiction, but we also want to examine the diagnosis of dependence, what dependence truly means, the types of addictions, such as work, sex, drugs, diet, exercise. We also want to look at tobacco and alcohol as some of the prevailing addictive substances in society. We're going to also look at second order effects of addiction on health, family, and relationships. So finally, we also want to look at the complications of addiction, but also the modern treatments and some of the monitoring post-treatment that can be beneficial to patients. So to do this, I have consultant psychiatrist Dr. Brian Wells with me. Brian specializes in substance disorders and has an international scope of clients. He leads a bespoke, discrete service that works closely with most of the quality addiction services and treatments globally. He specializes in addictive disorders and medical and surgical referrals where appropriate. Welcome to the podcast, Brian.
Hey, thanks very much, Owen. Good to be here.
Brian, I wondered if we could firstly just kick off by getting you to speak to a working definition of addiction or indeed substance misuse.
Well, I appreciate you asking that first because that's probably a long answer and people have been trying to define addiction and addictive disorders for a long time. So for me, it really started in 1976 when Griffith Edwards described the alcohol dependence syndrome, in which he described seven features which had to be present in order to diagnose dependence. And it was a meticulous study, so it's a landmark thing. I'm a fan of Griffith Edwards. He was a mentor of mine, and the biggest thing he did was describe the alcohol dependence syndrome. And it was for alcohol. It wasn't for cocaine or opioids or sort of sedatives. And I'll just rattle through them. But basically, it's to do with the substance or the activity. You then need to sort of transpose some of these features, not all of them, into other behaviors and other substances. But basically, the substance or the behavior becomes important to the person who's becoming dependent. You get a salience of drink-seeking behavior. People protect their supply. They make sure they got enough money to last the weekend because they know they're going to want to drink on Sunday. And it's to do with The other thing he found with alcohol was a thing that no one else has ever bothered with in any of these definitions, which is called the narrowing of the repertoire. So as we grow up, we drink in weddings, pubs, funerals, all over the place, lots of different environments. As we become more dependent, that repertoire narrows down to a point where I had a patient who would drink in a lavatory. He would keep a bottle in the cold cistern of the toilet. He would come in, take it out, put a warm one in, and he would sit in the toilet and drink in the toilet and couldn't understand why people were outside going to pubs and parties when they could do what he was doing, which is lock himself in a toilet. I would suggest that's a narrow drinking repertoire. And people who are becoming dependent, you know, they stay in, leave the curtains drawn. And so some of these features are amazing. Most of the drugs that we talk about, including alcohol and particularly opioids, people get a tolerance to them. So you start off as a 13-year-old kid drinking and you get a bit sloshed after a pint of beer. By the time you get to 18, you need three pints to get the same amount. But it does take a long time. With alcohol, you don't get a tolerance. Whereas with other drugs like opioids, you can get a tolerance very quickly. Within 6 weeks, you start off with a few, you know, 10-pound bag of heroin. And within 6 weeks, you're actually taking a lot more. You know, your tolerance with opioids goes up very rapidly. So it's the drug becomes important. You sometimes get a narrowing of the repertoire. You get a tolerance. And with most drugs, although not so much with the stimulants, you start to get withdrawal symptoms. And withdrawal varies from drug to drug. So with alcohol, it's tremor, it's nausea, vomiting, altered mood states, retching. With other drugs, it varies. There's not much of a withdrawal syndrome with stimulants like cocaine, but it happens at a cellular level. And the way it manifests is with craving. So somebody comes into rehab with taking 4 grams of cocaine. They have a detox. They get into the program. But the way they don't have the shakes, they don't have sweats, that sort of thing, which you do with opioids, which you do with alcohol. But what you get with high doses of cocaine and other stimulants, it happens at a cellular level. And about day number 5, you get an intense craving. And the person leaves treatment, goes out and goes to their dealer. Nobody could really understand it until they understood that actually withdrawal with stimulants happens at a cellular level in the brain. And so with withdrawal with alcohol, people then start to drink in order, not because they like the taste of a wine or whatever, but because they want to relieve the withdrawal symptoms. So you drink to relieve the withdrawal symptoms. And then as you progress into dependence, you start to get a compulsion to drink. You know, we've all had a compulsion. I am going to have that cream bun. Nothing's going to stop me. And that's what happens as we become dependent. We get a compulsion to drink or to use the drug. And that happens pretty quickly, depending on the drug and the route of administration, which is another important factor. It depends how you take these drugs. Quickest way to get addicted is to inhale them, whether you're smoking nicotine, whether you're smoking heroin. It's the quickest way to get it to the brain is actually to inhale it. A lot of people think it's to inject it. It's not. It's inhaling it, whether you're smoking it or inhaling it like an anesthetic. So what an anesthetist will do is he'll put us to sleep with an injection. You get a big dose of drug hitting the brain, and then he'll switch over to something that you inhale in and out because it's much more sensitive and you can control it better. And then the other thing that is kind of controversial, but it's very useful, is what Edwards described as the reinstatement of dependent drinking after a period of abstinence. Now, what that means is if you're in jail or it's Lent or it's Ramadan or whatever, if you're not drinking and you are dependent, if you start drinking again, you reinstate into dependent drinking with the craving, with the withdrawal, with the relief drinking, with the compulsion. And the more severely dependent you are, the more rapidly you reinstate. Now, that's kind of a hallmark of addictive disorders, because this whole question of, you know, can people control their drinking? Can they control their opioid use? It depends on the drug. It depends on the half-life of the drug. But the answer with alcohol is once they've become dependent, and there's a load of research now that supports it, it's very difficult to control your drinking. A lot of studies have claimed that these people had CBT or psychological treatments and they could now control their drinking. But when people went back and looked at those cohorts, the most famous of which was done by a group called the Sobels, and they said, yeah, all our people, they've returned to normal drinking. But when actually some abstinence fanatics went and looked at that cohort, they found that they were drunk, they were getting arrested, they were jumping off bridges. They were reinstating into dependent drinking. Now, that's a rather long-winded answer to your question, a working definition. I think that generally speaking, a good definition of addictive disorder is it's a chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive use, compulsive drug seeking and use, despite adverse consequences. So that's the number of different definitions all rolled up together, and it's quite succinct. I'll repeat it. It's a chronic relapsing disorder. I'm not saying it's a disease or anything like that. Chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use despite adverse consequences. And that kind of summarizes the whole thing rather well. And instead of drug seeking, it might be a behavior, it might be a process addiction, like shopping when you can't afford it or whatever. So I've given you a very long-winded kind of commentary on definitions there, Owen, but we can narrow it down or we can move on, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, really interesting, actually, Brian. So where we'll go to with it, actually, so everything you said there is absolutely I can identify with through 20 years in clinical practice myself as a paramedic and seen a lot of seeking behavior in the past. Like you said, tolerance and indeed recognized tolerance in myself for caffeine. You know, I think I must have had about 5 cups of coffee today and I still don't feel caffeinated. But the window of the range of tolerance seems to increase quite vastly despite the drug. But something you said there about mucous membrane absorption, you know, with the way we give medical drugs such as GTN, we put it into the mucous membranes quite quickly, and the mucous membranes within the pulmonary tree being a very effective facilitator of drug ingestion because of the narrowing mucous membranes according to the blood flow and how quickly it's absorbed into the bloodstream. But something where I'd like to take the interview right now, Brian, would be to, before we really narrow down on some more of the sort of typical drugs or drugs that people and or paramedics would interface with on a daily basis, if we could just pan back and look at some of the drugs and or activities and habits that you've treated people for in the past, which sit outside of pharmacological agents, such as work, such as sex, such as exercise. Could you speak to how people become addicted to these kind of activities and or habits?
Yeah, I mean, you quite often discover this when people want to retire. And they realize, oh, my God, I've been a lawyer all my life. And now what do I do? And I don't play golf and I don't, you know, I don't have hobbies. And actually work becomes a compulsive pastime. Other people know that they're going to retire. They plan for it. They play golf. They do, they have hobbies, all sorts of different ways of doing it. And they plan for their retirement. And the other thing that happens is people will cross addict. So they'll give up their drug of choice, like alcohol or cocaine, but then they'll get into shopping or sexually acting out or doing things basically that provide instant gratification. And that's probably the hallmark of things that are addictive. They give us instant gratification. You go down to Selfridges, spend 300 quid on a sweater you can't afford, and you kind of like it, you get excited, but then you go outside and feel bad because actually you've been very irresponsible and how are you going to pay the rent, for example. So the trouble with a lot of this kind of conversation is that people will cross addict. So particularly, I don't want to say particularly women, but let's say women who've had a cocaine problem go into rehab and they become abstinent from cocaine, but then they'll start to eat and then they put on weight and they can't bear it. And so they relapse. This happens quite a lot, cross addiction, or people will move from one addictive disorder into the other. So a number of people, if you talk to people who've being dependent on alcohol and they stop, they love the buzz of watching their horse come in first in the 4:30 at Newmarket or whatever. They'll move into gambling, or they'll go online casinos, or they'll do things that actually give instant gratification when you win, but they cause misery when you stop winning. So I know a guy who goes to Rome, has Armani suits made, doesn't bother to wear them, he just likes it, and then feels bad and gives them away to charity shops, doesn't even wear them. And it's a compulsive behavior that... So there are what we call process addictions, which would include things like shopping and sexual acting out and exercise, eating, things that are to do with instant gratification. And sometimes that can be the primary problem, but more often than not, it's secondary. In my clinical experience, it's been secondary to an addictive disorder that's involved alcohol or drugs. And I'm not including nicotine in that, although nicotine is obviously, it's probably the hardest drug to kick, actually. Talk to any heroin addict who's given up smoking, they'll tell you smoking was harder.
So Brian, just looking at the time horizon of an addicted person or a person that has a substance misuse issue, I mean, in my anecdotal experience, it seems to transcend the addiction or proclivity for the drug, seems to really start to transcend every moral, ethical, and time-bound desire of the person. Could you speak to that? Because I'm sure that's not where it starts. I'm sure it doesn't start there, but it seems to end there, whereby this immediacy for gratification starts to contravene every moral, ethical, and time-bound sort of issue that the patient is facing.
Yeah. Without getting too academic here, Owen, one of the interesting things about trying to come up with a definition of addiction is the word control. And when Griffith Edwards did his study on alcoholics, he found that they could actually control their drinking a certain percentage. So control was not part of the definition. And it became very controversial because depending on the drug, if you're inhaling cocaine, smoking crack, it's very difficult to stay in control of that. You lose control of it. You become a crazy person. You're taking huge amounts. You're disappearing to a hotel. You're getting prostitutes to bring in the cocaine. And, you know, it's really out of control. So in terms of things like the moral, ethical, and you know, normal kind of behavior of the person, I think it does depend on the drug and how it's being taken. And you get into a culture of, you know, you can actually control your drinking. There's loads of people who go to NA who didn't really have an alcohol problem. And then if they relapse into alcohol, they're able to control it for quite a while until it becomes a problem. And it may not become a problem. If your drug of choice has been smoking crack cocaine, you don't necessarily go on to, I mean, the wisdom is, hey, you don't drink for a couple of years and you really get to comfortable with the world of abstinence. But it does depend on the drug and how it's taken. And when you're injecting drugs or inhaling drugs, that can lead to a complete loss of control because it just gets to the brain more quickly. And it's like a wallop with a sledgehammer rather than a gentle kind of sniffing a line of coke on a Saturday night. When you start smoking it, it gets out of control very quickly.
We just speak to some of the meta-substances that you speak of, these being the almost the uppers or downers, stimulants and depressants and the opiates. Could you maybe sort of speak to the prevalence of them and indeed how you see them from your side of things?
Yeah, I mean, the prevalence keeps varying. I mean, these days we hear about, you know, endless overdoses on opioids like fentanyl from America, and that's shot up the prevalence of, you know, opioid use in the US, and the prevalence of overdoses has become a huge thing. That wasn't the case back in 1976. So the basic drugs are stimulant drugs. They wake us up, they elevate the mood, they depress the appetite. And so stimulant drugs include caffeine and nicotine and cocaine and the amphetamines, stimulant drugs, Adderall, things like that, amphetamine-like drugs. The sedative drugs include tranquilizers, so all the benzodiazepines, and depending on the half-life of the drug, if it's got a short half-life, it's marketed as a sleeping pill, like the diazepam or Valium is actually used for both. It's used as a sleeping pill and it's used as a tranquilizer as well, because the half-life is actually quite long. But if you've got a short half-life drug, and I'm going to put in the Z drugs in with the benzos, they're sedative drugs. They're marketed as sleeping pills. So you get a 6-hour sedation, which allows you to sleep. So you've got stimulants, you've got sedatives. What's the most commonly taken sedative drug in the world? Well, it's alcohol. And the first drug, the first fibers to get sedated are the stimulant fibers in the nervous system. So a couple of drinks, you actually feel like it's a stimulant because it's the sedative fibers that, it's the stimulant fibers that are getting sedated. So the effect is it's a couple of drinks makes you want to wake up and, you know, go dancing and chat, whatever. You get disinhibited. And it's the inhibitory pathways that get sedated first. So alcohol is the most commonly taken sedative drug in the world. Nicotine is interesting because a low dose is a stimulant. You wake up and have a few puffs to wake up. You're in a car accident. You get out and you take deep breaths of your drug of choice, which is nicotine, because it's a sedative at higher doses. So some of these substances have a dose-related response. And then opioids, which come from the opioid poppy, there's so many of them now, but some of them are derived all the way through from opium to morphine to diamorphine, which is heroin. And then there are the synthetic opioids, the codeines, and right up to the really strong stuff, such as fentanyl, most of which is coming from China, but distributed from Mexico. So fentanyl is a huge problem. And it's different to codeine. It's got a much more lethal, aggressive response because it's just so many. I think it's said to be 50 times stronger than heroin. So fentanyl it's like unleashing the tiger. How do you describe opioid drugs, the effect on opioid? It's very difficult to describe it. How do you describe what it's like to feel drunk? So opioid drugs, they you're still conscious if you haven't taken too much, but you get this kind of dopey, kind of, I don't really care if I'm in pain kind of thing going on, which is quite different to the way other analgesics work. You just don't care if you're kind of smoking opium and you're in pain, don't realize it, don't notice it.
So if we could speak to triggers, Brian, and if we could speak about, you know, just the fundamental aspects of triggers, and something also in the background, which you've observed, and it'd be great to get you to speak to, around sort of concomitant mental health and traumatic experiences from the past. Could you speak to the, sort of the prevalence of this and how it plays into addiction, or indeed the absence, whether it doesn't necessarily show any empirical or anecdotal linkage at all?
Okay, well, I kind of had an idea that you might be asking about trauma and things like that, because the world of addiction treatment and addictive disorders has, over the last few years, become the world of trauma. And I think for some very good reasons, but there are some people who are trauma experts, such as Gabor Mate and various other sort of people who are going around at conferences talking about, you know, trauma-informed treatment, and a lot of therapists are becoming trauma-informed therapists. And I think there's a very important place for it. But there is this idea that all addictive disorders are the result of traumatic experience, that childhood trauma or other forms of trauma, being in a war zone or whatever. There's no question that addictions and use of medications and use of addictive drugs and behaviors can be precipitated by traumatic experiences coming back from the war, coming back from, I mean, God knows what's going to be happening to these children in the Middle East, you know, when they're teenagers and adults. No question about it. It's the cause of addictive disorders is multifactorial. And for example, with alcohol, it's not just traumatic experiences. We know that there is a genetic component with alcohol. In twin studies, for example, done in Scandinavia, we know that if you're an identical twin and your twin becomes alcohol dependent, you've got over an 80% chance of becoming alcohol dependent yourself. It's a genetic thing. And they're quite sophisticated studies, and they're often ignored these days. So the old-fashioned treatment used to be, you know, you've got an addiction, you've got a dependence, you become abstinent, you stay abstinent, you go to 12-step meetings, and you, you know, life just goes on and you get into a solid recovery and enjoy it. Now, that's the old model of treatment. These days, everybody's offered, you know, EMDR and brain spotting and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, although when I grew up, it was a good idea to be abstinent for a while before you enter into some of these treatments for things like childhood sexual trauma. I mean, you shouldn't probably, people don't have the ego strength to be able to do that kind of work within a 28-day treatment program. And it would be seen by some people as irresponsible to even go there for, you know, at least a year. If you talk to psychodynamic therapists, they'll say, you know, it's crazy to start giving people trauma treatment in the first 2 weeks of their rehab. You know, people need to be abstinent in order to then be able to take advantage of well-conducted and appropriate trauma treatments. So it's a complicated issue because people are running treatment centers and they want to give people a pile of different treatment modalities during, a 28-30-day treatment. And it can turn into a bit of a circus. I've been in some places where, you know, people don't actually know what the hell's going on. They don't know which organization to get their mutual support from. The family system gets thrown in. People will start looking at all kinds, you know, they'll sit in a Native American sweat box. You know, there's all kinds of treatments thrown in. And probably, If you're really dependent on a substance, particularly alcohol, particularly opioids, it's probably a good idea to be abstinent. It really is a good idea to stop using the drug, be abstinent, and that might require a detox, and it might require, the best way I know of people being abstinent is using mutual support groups, using a 12-step type program. But this is, I'm being controversial now. The 12-step movement these days is seen as old-fashioned. It started in 1935 in Akron, Ohio, useful for old men like me, but actually it's very uncool. There isn't a treatment center in California that says we do 12-step based treatment. They're all doing trauma-informed therapy. They're using brain spotting. They're using going out into the woods and all kinds of stuff, which can be very good when it's done at the right time in the right manner. I don't know whether that answered the question, but there's no question that mental illness, including trauma, is a major factor in people becoming addicted. No question about it.
Yeah, indeed. And like you said, the linkage there seems to be profound. Brian, could you speak to, I'll put this in the show notes as well. I've seen a fantastic lecture from yourself, which very much informed this conversation. And in that lecture, you were talking about two of the biggest killers and two of the biggest addictive substances being that of alcohol and tobacco. Could you speak to these only from a, is it the availability of these substances or is it the social acceptability of these substances? Because hands down, they are the biggest killers. They seem to be cause probably the biggest burdens to the NHS and any developed health system which encompasses an emergency service. Could you speak to your thoughts on tobacco and alcohol?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, when it comes to how do we solve the world's drug problems, I'm no expert on this. However, there's no question that the biggest drug problem in the world is tobacco. Even though fentanyl is hitting the headlines, tobacco is still the biggest. Alcohol is also a major public health problem. And if you look at places where alcohol is available, and you mentioned availability, and you mentioned social acceptability, it's complicated to know that in order for them to become a problem, they've got to be available and they've got to be consumed by that society. What people are often surprised about is when you look at the world of prohibition in America, and it was, you know, there was only illegal alcohol coming into Chicago and, you know, being run in by mobsters and the Kennedy family and things like that. Actually, prohibition was a very effective harm reduction thing in America at that time. There were very few alcohol-related problems, very few car crashes, murders, the kind of things that you see, great lists you see of people going to A&E as a result of alcohol. It was very unpopular. People wanted to drink. It's a bit like the whole thing about cannabis becoming legalized. It became a political issue. And so alcohol became legalized throughout these different states that actually prohibited alcohol for several years. It was just a voting, very unpopular, but very effective harm reduction thing. So if it's not available, if it's really difficult to get hold of, that actually reduces the availability of a substance to society. If you're already dependent, like if you're alcoholic and you're in Sweden where alcohol is very expensive, for example, so it makes it less available, you find it. If you're dependent, you'll go and brew your own, or you'll go and persuade someone to give you illegal substances or illegal alcohol. If once you're dependent, you'll get your drugs, you'll find them. I think a good example of what I'm trying to explain here is people, if you're in America a few years ago, they would say, look at Amsterdam, they've got it all under control. You can buy cannabis in the coffee shops. They take out, these buses go around and they give out drugs to opioid addicts and methadone, and they actually have injectable, you know, clinics and things like that, which has also been done in Portugal more recently. At that time, if you went to Amsterdam, there was more crime, there was more HIV, there was more illicit drug use than anywhere else in Europe. It's just, depending on who you talk to, they think, oh, the Dutch really know how to control, and you know, it's they have this laissez-faire attitude towards drug use. It's fine if you can keep the lid on it. But it just wasn't true. Depending on who you spoke to, Amsterdam and its drug use was chaos, and people were going from all over the world to Amsterdam. Now, the Portuguese had a similar episode where they had injecting clinics and they were giving drugs, and it was this whole slightly liberalized, much more, it was less punitive, it was less stigmatized. But I gather that it's not working so well anymore because the funding for these places is dried up. And so while it was a very interesting exercise in harm reduction, etc., a couple of years ago, I think it's now struggling. So it's a complicated issue, but your question is, what is it? Is it availability or social acceptability? It has to be both. It has to be the less available a drug is, the less problems a society has with it. No question about it.
So Brian, I'm going to roll two questions into one really around dependence. So firstly, if you could define dependence, but then if you could just speak to the pattern of dependence and how easy it is to sort of slip back into dependence.
You see, I think that I'm giving you some long-winded answers here, Owen, and I don't know how academic to make it. But if you go back to the dependence syndrome, I see that as a gold standard. What Griffith Edwards did was he found seven factors that needed to be present in order for dependence to be diagnosed. And if you'd got, say, three of those factors, so if you just drink a lot, you get an increased tolerance, you get some withdrawal, but not all the time. And, you know, you don't get a compulsion, you don't get a reinstatement after abstinence, but you don't get a narrowing of the repertoire. But everybody who drinks on a regular basis gets a tolerance, and it becomes a matter of degree. So you might be a recreational drinker for all of your life with an increased tolerance. Anyone who drinks is going to get an increased tolerance. And sometimes you get drunk and take, you know, a bit of Dutch courage, or, you know, get drunk at a party or whatever. And then you become widowed or you become retired, and suddenly you've got nothing else to do all day, or you're in grief, and you start to drink in a way that moves from recreational and heavy recreational drinking into dependent drinking. And dependent drinking, as we've talked about, has these features where you get a compulsion. And if you stop, once you're dependent, you're very likely to reinstate, to go back to dependent use, if it's alcohol and if it's an opioid. I don't know if that's been shown for stimulants, but it's definitely been shown for alcohol and opioids. So personally, you see, they stopped in America, they stopped talking about dependence and they started talking about substance use disorder. So you'd have an alcohol use disorder, you'd have an opioid use disorder, and you'd have a mild or moderate or severe. Now, severe substance use disorder is the same as dependence. Dependence I used to find very useful, because if you were moderately to severely dependent on anything, chances were you needed to be abstinent from those substances. So it was much easier to sit down with somebody and do an assessment and figure out, now, is this person simply a heavy recreational user? Are they experimental? Are they recreational? Is it heavy recreational? Are there problems? Is it hazardous or harmful drinking or drug use? Or is it dependent drinking? And once it moves into dependent drinking, if that dependence becomes moderate or severe, chances are their best bet is going to be to become abstinent. And so for me, that was a sort of clarity that was always there. It's become a bit muddled now with the substance use disorder labels or diagnostic labels, and also the use of all these other factors that come into it, the mental health, the trauma, the cost of rehab. It's become a bit of a circus. So I'm an old-fashioned guy. I liked the dependent syndrome, but I'm in a minority when it comes to the way people think these days.
I can very much.
Did that tie together?
It did actually. And it does make sense. And, you know, like you said, in a microcosm, it makes sense from just what we might be thinking of more socially acceptable habits and or addictions, such as caffeine and or tobacco, whereby, like you say, the tolerance builds and builds and builds, but adverse social incidents and events very much shift the spectrum of habit to a very different place, where it becomes, like you say, far more of a seeking behavior. I'm going to flip it on its head for a second, Brian, and just ask you about clients and the types of clients you found difficult to treat. And we just spoke offline about this, and I really appreciate your perspectives, really, because one of the things we did say is that outsourcing your help and or your psychological robustness is not necessarily helpful, because actually what you need to do is be able to internalize and put fail safes or indeed barriers in your own in your own habits to then circumvent and or guide you on the right path. And the issue when you outsource a lot of your help in daily life is that this is very different when you're speaking about addiction. You can't outsource this. But can I just turn it over to you? What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are you're a very sophisticated interviewer as a starting point. And so if I was asked, who are the difficult patients to treat? Traditionally, what we find is difficult patients to treat are VIPs. They are professionals, doctors, lawyers, airline pilots. And they started to discover that these guys, these people, these men and women, probably if they had a longer treatment and then were subjected to post-treatment monitoring, like from 3 to 5 years, they actually did better than everybody else, because their licenses to practice medicine or to fly airplanes were at stake. And if they were tested doing after post-treatment monitoring and found to have been using alcohol or cocaine or whatever, they lost their license. Now, that is a pretty damn good deterrent. And at the same time, they were encouraged to embrace the joys of abstinence-based recovery. So there are lots of these kind of professional units that sprung up. And the idea was, it was actually started by a guy called Garrett O'Connor, who did it on airline pilots at LAX airport. They got 90 days of treatment, and then they were followed up for 3 to 5 years of intensive monitoring. And the guy would say, I'm not your friend, I'm going to come around on Sunday and you're going to give me a urine sample. Those people did the best of anybody else, because something like 86% of doctors who went through that kind of program were abstinent 5 years later. It's a sort of landmark bit of work. There are other cultures where the usual kind of rehab models don't necessarily apply. So, for example, if you're in India, a couple of patients I've had have been the wives of high-profile Indians who they got drunk at weddings, and they were not treated like people who needed help. They were thrown in the basement. They brought the family into shame and treated like criminals. So there's a cultural element to it as well. And so, you know, people in the Middle East often have very different values. They have, you know, there's always the legendary Middle Eastern wealth that young people have. If, you know, if you grow up in somewhere like Saudi Arabia or in one of the ruling families, there's a lot of wealth around. And there's sometimes not much incentive to knuckle down and, you know, go to school. But other times, you know, people do. They go to good schools. They come to Europe. They go to Sandhurst. They go to universities. They, you know, and they don't just spend their time driving fast cars, chasing girls and hanging out in casinos. But there's a subgroup of Middle Eastern men who do that. And they're very difficult to treat because what are they going to do? They don't have jobs. They're not going to subscribe to the same values that most of us in the UK or in America or in Europe actually do. They have a very different value system, a very different lifestyle. And so we can't just impose, it's unrealistic to think it's going to work well. I think that some people who've been difficult to treat have been celebrities. They're often surrounded by, it was very interesting watching the David Beckham program because it was fun to watch. But actually, one's had contact with people like that. And they're surrounded by people who go in and they make sure everything's going to be the way the boss wants. Some of these celebrities, very difficult to get paid because they got three accountants. All of them need to sign the check. Oh, sorry. Accountant number two is away this week, you know, but their job is to look good for the boss and to insist on every taxi receipt. And it can be a bloody nightmare working with some of these people because you just can't get through. You can't get beyond the lawyers or the agents or the record company or the managers or whatever. And so they can be very difficult to treat. You know, every therapist in London says, I wish I'd got my hands on Amy Winehouse. Well, good luck. You know, she was extremely difficult to treat. And there was the husband, there was the dad, there was the career. There were so many different agendas flying around. It was so difficult for that poor girl to go, well, you know, she didn't, you know, what was she going to do? She was just going to, you know, stick to do what she wanted to do. It was very difficult. And at the same time, one of your questions actually that we were going to talk about is interventions and post-intervention monitoring. It can be really, really powerful. And if you know that you're going to be monitored and you're going to have urine samples and hair samples and stuff taken, you know, it gives you a pretty good incentive to be abstinent. If that's something that's part of your lifestyle, if you know, if you're going to lose your license or lose your family or whatever as a result of relapsing, then being monitored is a very useful thing to do. But look, it's courses for horses. Not everybody's going to fit in to the same ideology, the same mode of treatment. It really does need to be a thorough assessment and then helping people to become enthusiastic about their own lives and using positive psychology and using exercise. I mean, if doctors could prescribe four things that would make us all feel great, they would be good nutrition, good sleep, good exercise, some sort of living spiritual thing, whether it's yoga, meditation or whatever. Now, doctors can't prescribe any of those things. You get quite a few of them if you go to 12-step fellowships. You get, you know, a spiritual ideology that you can subscribe to if you want. You know, it's good to do yoga and Pilates, good to do exercise, good to sort of get into interested in nutrition so that you're a healthy weight, that sort of thing. Doctors can't prescribe any of that, but if we actually paid more attention to it, rather than letting people cross addict and putting on a load of weight and all that sort of stuff, then it's very much part and parcel of what we have available as treatment, part of treatment programs.
And to that point, Brian, you know, something you were saying about post-intervention monitoring is a semblance of accountability. Because like you said, if you're coming around on Sunday to take a urine sample and or a blood sample, there's accountability there and a consequence as well. So I think, something you said about airline pilots and or professionals is that if you are on a post-intervention plan or monitoring plan, there is a semblance of if I fail and consistently fail, my profession and my career is going to be removed, and the consequences of that are going to be astronomical. So there's this almost this counterplay of accountability and consequence, which probably plays into it as well. But like you said, it's difficult if there is no necessarily no consequence, and the accountability piece isn't there necessarily because you don't prescribe to a certain career pathway or indeed institution, which might have consequences. And like you said, it's the absence of that makes it very difficult to treat.
Do you know what the best form of intervention is and the most common form of intervention? It's the family. And the family, after they've been bashed around, and you know, if they can actually get their act together, they are the ones who do the best interventions. And they'll say, look, darling, I'm just not putting up with another weekend like we had last weekend. And you need to go and see this person or that therapist or whatever, and do as they say. I mean, they sometimes a kind of carefully rehearsed intervention can actually work. They can also backfire. But the family are the main reason why people actually get help, why they get well. They actually just get fed up with being bashed around by an unreliable, unpredictable person who's drinking and not paying the bills properly. And they get the person well. So families, we haven't really talked about, but there's a whole world of how families are affected and family members are adversely affected by addictive behavior in the wife or in the mother or in the, you know, people go on about granddaddy used to go out and, you know, drunk and shooting a shotgun at the moon and stuff. And he was seen as a bit of a character, but chances are he was pretty alcohol dependent. So families is a big thing. I slightly lost my thread there. What was the point? What get me back on track there, Owen?
Yeah, indeed. So it was actually the post-intervention monitoring, but I was actually going to come on to the family actually, Brian, because like you said, you know, it's prudent to look at the second and third order effects of addiction, those on relationships, family, work, health, and finances. And like you said, family are often the first in the firing line because they feel the immediate effects of addiction, and often the after effects as well. And those fundamental relationships of family are often the first ones to be tested and or pushed to the limits. So it was I was very much actually going to explore that with you. And as an extension of that, really around finance and around health and around work relationships, because my experience of seeing addiction as a clinician is that it's very difficult to keep an addiction from bleeding into all different aspects of one's life. Yeah. And before long, because of tolerance and because of the occult nature of a substance, it's unknown quantities and quality, it bleeds into professional life, it bleeds into your socioeconomic life, and you know, the way you steward finances, and into your health as well. And so I think, you know, from people being able to feel like they can control it, or it fits into a certain box, before they know it, it bleeds across all aspects of their life. Could you speak to that?
Well, I think that it was highlighted by psychologists in America, people like Claudia Black and Sharon Wegscheider-Cruz, and people like that started to write books about, you know, the family system and how alcoholism and drug addiction was impacting it. And actually, you find that, you know, it's pretty well known now that family members are often in need of more treatment than the actual person who's anesthetizing their feelings with drugs and alcohol, the family members. But the trouble was that then they wanted to get them all treated for post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever. And the insurance company started to go, whoa, we're not covering that. And there was a whole recession in the world of rehab, because people were wanting all these family members to be treated for depression or anxiety or PTSD or whatever on insurance. And so the whole industry kind of collapsed to some extent. After the, in the late 90s, the only rehabs that survived were places like Hazelden that had literature, or, it was lots of places actually couldn't afford to continue because the insurance companies said no. And, the insurance companies have dictated things. 28 days is purely an insurance-based thing. Who needs 28 days? Well, some people need 3 days and some people need 3 months. And if you've relapsed, you don't necessarily need another 28 days to go back. It's just to do with the way insurance companies have sort of set out their criteria, really. So to get families well again can be really difficult. And I think, I don't know what the figures are, I actually don't, but I suspect that post-treatment, probably more families and marriages break up than survive, unless the family all gets involved in the process. So I've got a sponsor who's in Pennsylvania, in the woods of Pennsylvania. And so I go stay with them. And on Saturday night, he and I, we go to AA, and the wife goes to Al-Anon, and the kids go to Alateen, and the dog goes to Alipet, and we all go to Häagen-Dazs afterwards. And it's a good Saturday night out. The family are all involved with the process, and it's very healthy. But it's difficult to make that happen. And in different cultures, like in Europe, very difficult to get the family involved. They don't go to things like Al-Anon or treatment. They say, I'm sending dad to treatment, you fix him. And we expect him to, be like he was 40 years ago when he comes out of treatment. That doesn't happen like that. So it's complicated. And there's no question that, addictive disorders are a major public health problem. It's something like 60% of men in the UK and in America have what we would call an alcohol use disorder. It's not necessarily dependence. It's a use, they're drinking in a hazardous or harmful way. 60%, and something like, 20% of women, although women are actually underdiagnosed. And these are mothers of children and aunts and grandmothers and all kinds of people. So addictive disorders is a major public health problem. And a lot of people don't actually pick up on it. They think, well, the guy's just kind of depressed, or why is he falling about? They don't think maybe they're drinking too much. Maybe they're taking drugs. A lot of this stuff is concealed. They're taking sleeping pills. Who knows? Well, it's part of our job to find out. And so we can find out. And it's worth actually keeping that in mind. Is this a problem of a substance use disorder, or is it something else? And quite often, we read about celebrities who've suddenly passed away. There've been a couple recently, and I don't know for sure, but I lay a bet that, there's been some fatty changes in their liver, and they've probably gone into heart failure as a result of, really extravagant drug and alcohol use over their, when they were rich and famous and successful. Probably messed up a lot of organs in their body, which is why they're passing away in their early 50s. And that happens. And happens as a result of their drug use. And there have been some very well-known names who've passed away as a result of fentanyl in the last few years. So, it's a big deal. It's not just people like me go on about it because they've been affected by it personally and they've actually got interested in it. It is a major public health problem. And things like nicotine, cause horrendous amounts of illness and they don't help with longevity.
Brian, as we're coming to land on the conversation, actually, I just wondered if we could just visit two more aspects in the interview. One would be around interventions that you do see work and that you advocate for within addiction. And then maybe just in an anecdotal case from your perspective, just a case study where you have seen the possibility of addiction turnaround, so that someone who's really maybe been in the throes of a florid or profound addiction, but has turned it around. But maybe if we could get you to speak to initially just the empirically proven or treatments which you advocate for.
I think that it's about professional awareness and family awareness and society's awareness that, you know, maybe mum is actually drinking too much. Maybe there's something we could do about this. She's not a bad person and needs to become good. She's not a weak person and needs to become strong. She's not well and she needs to become well. And the best way of achieving that is to help her, not in a judgmental way, but help her realize that, you know, it's very interesting looking at alcohol. These days, the national and international recommended guidelines for alcohol just change every few months. I think it's not recommended anybody drinks at all at the moment in the UK. Certainly pregnant women, no drink. Women, I think it's been reduced again. Men, I don't know what the recommended daily dose or weekly dose is. And then, it's, of course, it's different in Italy or different in Germany. So it's a muddle. And in terms of national and international kind of sensible rules and regulations and licensing hours and all that, it's a total muddle. It's a complete muddle. But it's important to be aware that, you know, there's going to be loads of problems with cannabis as cannabis becomes increasingly recognized and legalized. And, you know, it's a bit like alcohol and prohibition was. Now, there are very few states in America where you can't legally smoke cannabis. It's a whole industry. And if you go to somewhere like Denver, or what's that town near Denver? I forget the name of it. Beautiful little town. Everybody's stoned. You have conversation. I went into a bank and the guy behind the counter had been smoking weed. You know, that can't be okay. Can't remember the name of the town, but it was very nice.
Was it Big Boulder?
Maybe, yeah, it was in Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
And I went into a Wells Fargo bank and the guy was off his face. And we had an inane, quite funny conversation. I couldn't quite believe it, but it was all legal. You know, we actually talked about it. That can't be sensible, you know. And I'm sure he was actually breaking the house rules by being stoned, but, you know, going off for his 11s and coming back with red eyes and, you know, talking nonsense. But I think that there are interventions. I think that there's a lot that. How do you actually broadcast the word that actually addictive disorders are highly treatable, which they are? Modern treatments are very effective. You know, so CBT and motivational enhancement and 12-step facilitation are very effective treatments. And there are treatments now that weren't around for trauma and trauma-informed treatment. EMDR can be extremely powerful. Brain spotting can be extremely powerful. But it's about helping the person understand they're not bad and we're not getting on your case here. We're trying to help you. And these are ways, little interventions, treatment plans that can actually help you feel better about yourself, help you improve your self-esteem, help you actually enjoy, you know, what is in fact a pretty amazing world that we live in. And it's about being open and being positive and knowing how to refer to people and being open to things. And then trying again, don't ever kind of blow someone out, even if they've got brain damage and liver damage. You know, be open, and it's a useful attitude to never give up on somebody, to say there's always hope, even if it's giving them antabuse or something like that, if they've got brain damage, and to know when to refer and where to refer to. Because this is, you know, people tend to know which cardiologist to refer to. You know, heart disease is obviously the biggest killer. And we all know about, you know, good GPs and cardiologists. It's still stigmatized. It's still addictive disorders are still seen as you know, oh, it's not okay. You know, it's skullduggery. It's witchcraft, and that really does need to change.
Brian, listen, that's fantastic, and just a real just a really rounded answer. But also, like you said, it's prudent to never give up on people with addiction abuse, because they can absolutely turn things around. Just as we finish off on the interview, A couple of things. Number one is I will put the links to a fantastic interview and indeed YouTube, a video that you have conducted online for listeners to watch. It makes absolutely fascinating viewing. But I'll also put an email for yourself, indeed for your services, to on the show notes, just so that people can find you if they want to know further. Sure. But I'm coming to land, could I just get you to speak to some take home messages around addiction and or substance misuse that you'd like to leave listeners with?
Well, I think we've just covered them actually. There's things like, don't ever give up. Always leave the door open. There's no such thing as an utterly hopeless case. I mean, people do die, and they do. There's an increased risk of suicide. There's an increase this, increase that, and men in particular their lifespan will be shortened by use of alcohol and use of drugs, and to be aware of it and to be. I don't want to say sympathetic, but to be pragmatic about the fact that this is a serious public health thing that actually can be intervened on. It can be treated. Modern treatments are very successful, very powerful, and they can be fun. And it can be very challenging on the one hand, but it can be very fulfilling to work with this client group. And if I have any ambitions, it would be to encourage people to actually work in the field of addiction treatment, because provided you do it as a team, not isolated on your own, if you're working as part of a functioning and well-run team, it can be a fantastic way of running and being part of a professional life and being of use to the world, to society, and everybody you know, because everybody knows somebody with an addiction problem.
Dr. Brian Wells, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, pleasure.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.